Hello, everybody. Welcome in to the Lakers Collective. And guess what? We're halfway there. The halfway
there we go.
Of the season. Shout out Bon Jovi. I had to play that real quick and then shut it off before we get dinged. Happy to see you all here. I'm Trevor Layton, joined by Jason Timp, Jovan Buha. Guys, how are we doing? The halfway point of the season, 41 games in.
What's up, dudes? It's good to see you. I think that might be the most impressive 2-3 week of basketball that I've seen from the Lakers this season. It's weird. If you would have told me before the week they go 2-3, I'd be like, ooh, that's a disaster. But like their two wins were so impressive. And honestly, I just thought Charlotte and Sacramento played so well that like I kind of am at peace with the way the Lakers are progressing over the last week.
We are halfway there. It was a long first half of the season. I'm intrigued by the second half and what the Lakers end up doing and if this team can finally get whole and just what that looks like. But 25-16 on a 51 pace, also the sixth seed, though. That just shows the state of the Western Conference right now. Ninth in offense, 26th in defense. Certainly some things to clean up, but it's a solid first half of the season for LA.
Yeah, so for context, the Lakers last season at this point, they were 23-18, and they were also the sixth seed at this stage last season. So the sixth seed, I don't think, is going to have Lakers fans happy because we're going to remember, well, they finished as the three seed last year, even though they're two games better this year than they were last year. But we've seen the highs and lows of this team. We've seen a floor that has been pretty low. We've also seen a ceiling, particularly in the offensive end, that's been pretty high. We've seen a season that has been marred by a number of injuries. They've been one of the most injured teams in the NBA. There's certainly been a number of other teams that have dealt with injuries, though, too. But all in all, the Lakers hanging in there right now, not quite living on a prayer at this moment, but hopefully they can get Austin Reaves back and healthy and then really get rolling in the near future here. But last night took on the Toronto Raptors, had a tough week, 5 games in 7 nights. How about LeBron James playing all 5 of them at 41 years old? I did not have that on my bingo card. Didn't think that was going to happen. Let's start with the game against Toronto, and then we'll get into the entire week. Jason, I know you're fairly optimistic about the week itself. What did you think about the Lakers last night? A rare blowout win for LA.
Yeah, so again, like I think one of the things that happened when Austin Reaves went out and when Rui has been out, and since he's come back, he's been a little rusty, although he made some shots in the second half last night, that you've seen kind of like a dip in the play of the role players that has made it really difficult for the Lakers to win unless their stars are amazing. And one of the interesting things about the last week is like when they made shots against Atlanta and against Toronto, they won. When their role players made catch and shoot threes and kind of paid off those sequences. And then when they shot really poorly, they really struggled. And I think we can kind of expect that until Austin gets back and until Rui gets into form or until some of these trades come in. And so honestly, like, I think that's some of the reality we have to come to terms with. What I really liked was they had a couple of wins against two very athletic teams in Atlanta and in Toronto, where they stayed away from some of the issues that they had in other matchups against those athletic teams. Like, Luka and LeBron, relatively efficient shot making. I know Luka got off to a rough start last night, but I thought he got better as the game progressed. And overall, I continue to think Luka's progressing in the right direction in terms of hitting more of his threes, turning the ball over less. LeBron's been playing great now for the better part of a month. And just in general, not succumbing to the issues that they did in those games, like just getting run off the floor in transition, getting bludgeoned at the point of attack. They were scrapping. And I thought really the story of last night's game was that lineup that they started the second quarter with, yeah, with Marcus Smart at point, Jared Vanderbilt at the 2, LeBron at the 3, Drew Timmy at the 4, DeAndre Ayton at the 5. Just a comically large lineup, kind of like leaning into what you do have athletically available to you, which is size, and playing a lot of 2-3 zone. The Lakers played over 40 possessions of 2-3 zone last night and held the Raptors to an offensive rating that was like in the mid-60s in those possessions. So a lot of successful zone looks last night. The LeBron-led units with Luka off the floor continued to do really well. And while the first half Luka alone unit struggled, I thought they played much better in the second half to kind of set up that final run. I just think a lot of things are progressing in the right direction. Obviously, they still have some personnel deficits to where, like, guess what? If they go into Denver tomorrow and the role players miss threes, they're probably not going to win. again, that's the reality we just kind of have to come to terms with. But like, all of the controllables right now, I think, are trending in the right direction for the Lakers.
Jovan, optimism there from Jason. Where were you at after last night's win?
So optimism off of last night's win, I would say I'm a little bit more pessimistic on the week than Jason is, because I think with both Charlotte and Sacramento, I saw some trends with this team that we have seen throughout the entirety of the season, where when their shots are not falling and a team's, an opponent's shots are falling, there starts to be a just collective letting go of the rope. So I think in both instances, yes, there was some ridiculous shot making from both Charlotte and Sacramento, but then that bled into other parts of the game. And I was not happy with LA's overall effort and urgency and focus in those two games, particularly defensively. I thought there was a lot of letting go of the rope, and it was like, okay, we're missing wide open threes, they're hitting contested threes, or they're getting us in rotation and we're playing good defense for 16 seconds. Then there's a breakdown. Then they get an offensive rebound or they get an open three, whatever. And then all of a sudden you see the Lakers drop their heads and not get back in transition, or just not play the defense that they've shown they're capable of recently. So I would say there's a little bit still of that. Of, to me, this is a group that is still somewhat like with most of the role players, and it's understandable to a degree. I just think they have too many of these guys. A lot of their effort comes down to being involved in the offense and how they're performing offensively. When guys aren't making shots, you see this group start to kind of check out. And I think that is a bit of a problem, that especially against better teams, because I think one clear trend that I've noticed with this group, I have much less confidence against with the Lakers against good offenses than I do against good defenses. Like, you see the better defenses, if those teams are bad offensively, the Lakers can hang. But if you get a team that's really good offensively, that's where I think, as long as they could defend the Lakers at like an average-ish level, their offense will overwhelm LA. So that's still something I think they got to figure out. But to go to last night specifically, I really like the 2-3 zone. I think we saw it even against Portland too. Like, it's been a couple games now in a row where LA has been able to leverage their size against speed and athleticism and be like, we're going to go with a jumbo lineup. And when you have Vando and Marcus Smart as the top two guys in that 2-3 zone, like, good luck shooting the gaps there, or trying to penetrate, make passes. Like, those two guys were awesome at the top of the zone, and then you had a bunch of size with LeBron, DA, and Timmy. And we've talked about, with LeBron, obviously the defensive focus can wane at times, but when LeBron is in a lineup that is playing with a certain defensive energy, LeBron does not want to be the weak link, and LeBron buys in. And I think, again, we've talked about, like, LeBron with the Banshees, those lineups have tended to be really good, and LeBron has been a big part of that. So I really like that. And then Jason has hit on this as well, but like, I really like the transition play from this group lately. Five straight games of winning the fast break points battle, and they've won it in 7 of 8, and that's a departure from earlier in the season. On the season, they are 23rd in the league in fast break points. Over the past 8 games, they're 7th, and I think we've seen LeBron be a big part of this, Marcus be a big part of this. Marcus has turned into a one-man fast break at times, including that Atlanta game. 3 straight possessions just getting out in transition. So I think there's certainly been some things to be positive with. I just also think, like, this group should not be as dependent on making shots to play hard. That's ultimately where I'm still at. Like, they are way too results dependent rather than process dependent, in my opinion.
I agree with that. And by the way, let's break in real quick here. The All-Star starters for the West and East were just announced, but for the West, Luka Doncic, indeed an All-Star starter as expected, joining Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Steph Curry, Nikola Jokic, and Victor Wembanyama in the starting five for the West starters. So congrats to Luka. Not unexpected. We knew he was going to get there. He was a leading vote getter.
Well deserved.
But well deserved. Luka Doncic, all-star starter for the Lakers. You mentioned when we look at that shift that started the second quarter, I love that group as well. I thought there was an element of that when people are looking at DeAndre Ayton and him having such a big night, 10 for 10 from the field. Would he have 25 and 13 in that game? And I saw a lot of, see, you have to feed the big man. See, you just got to give Ayton the ball and he can get going. I think there's a couple things we have to remember there. Number one, it's that, well, Toronto was missing their starting center in Jakob Poeltl. They lost Colin Murray-Boyles midway through. So Ayton had this big size advantage all game. Don't get me wrong, the advantage was in front of him. He took complete advantage of that advantage. He was awesome. and had a great game. But we talk about that intensity level and getting going in a game. It felt like with that group that was on the floor, Ayton started to show flashes at the end of the first. And then once he's on the floor with Vando and Smart, and then they're making plays and LeBron's doing things and Drew Timmy was moving the ball, and we could talk more about him later. It's like there was no choice but for Ayton to like come along with those guys. And then he picked it up and wound up having a huge game for the Lakers, and his best game, I think, that we've seen in quite a while. So having that group out there that provides that athleticism and that intensity, I'll tell you what, it was great to see a group that just competed, played hard. It's amazing what just playing really, really hard can mean in an NBA game and the difference that it can make. That group was really selling out and doing everything they could to get those stops, get out in transition, run. They were having fun. It was a noticeable difference once they started to filter that group out. Suddenly it was like Luka and Rui were on the floor, and the energy level just dropped significantly after they didn't have that group out there. But that group, I think, sparked something for them. It was really cool to see in last night's game that they were able to get that out there. It's something we'd like to see here moving forward. A lot of fans talking about Drew Timmy as well. I guess let's jump into that here. Drew Timmy's played well over the first couple of games here that he's been in the rotation. JJ Redick seems to be pretty happy with him. Yet at the same time, I know fans are very excited about him. We've been talking about the Lakers needing athleticism and defense, and those are two things that are not Drew Timmy. So real quick, Jason, what are your thoughts on Drew Timmy and him on this Lakers team and potentially here moving forward?
Fitting into the same concept you were hitting at, like I think one of the things that makes Drew Timmy a useful rotation player at this time of year is that there is real margin to gain by playing hard. Like in this time, it's so funny. Every year kind of seems to follow this pattern where at the start of the year, you know, the good teams seem to get out to great starts. They just do, because they come in, they're focused in training camp. That's when they're most dialed in. And then what ends up happening is you get into January, December, January, and you start to see slippage across basically every good team that got off to a great start, even the Thunder in this case. And then what ends up happening is some of the teams that had high expectations that faltered out the gates, they're playing like gangbusters in December and January because they're desperately trying to save their season. That's why the Clippers and the Warriors have the best records in the NBA over the last month. And the point being there is that difference in effort and engagement level between opponents matter most in this chunk of the season. Less in October, November, less in March and April, more in December, January, a little bit in that early February. And so when you have a guy like Drew Timmy, who like actually has a lot of really strong fundamental basketball stuff, like the dude compared to most people his size can like dribble, pass, shoot better than most of them, and has a high basketball IQ, understands spacing, understands where to be on the floor, and same thing goes for defense. Yeah, if you put him on opening night against the Warriors, he's probably going to be overwhelmed athletically, right? But like in this chunk of the season, just him going out there and playing his ass off, playing super hard. What stood out to me last night was just how hard he was running the floor. And I think an important detail with that bench unit that led the second quarter, they were running like crazy. There were some really fun sequences there where like they'd get a stop and a rebound, and you'd see a dude streaking down the middle of the ball with two dudes running the wings. And they would just, it would like be, look like this wave of athletic size going across the screen. You just didn't see that much with the Lakers throughout this season. And that's what it looks like when DeAndre's running like that, and Vando's running like that, and LeBron's running like that. The stat you shared, Jovan, by the way, about the transition scoring over the last eight games, I found very fascinating that you shared on Twitter. I think it was last night. But ultimately, the Drew Timmy thing to me is he just allows them to leverage their size. His ability to shoot allows him to play at the four, and he's just a smart player who plays really hard, who I think brings a lot of value in this chunk of the season.
Yeah, he's been, I thought it was very smart the way JJ Redick deployed him as well in that lineup. That was a lineup that specifically could cover for some of the weaknesses that he provides. I mean, the moment he stepped on the floor, they got him the ball in the high post, and then he went to work, and Ayton was able to get a tip in, whether or not it was offensive basket interference or not. Ayton tipped it in, didn't get called, and the Lakers got a bucket. They went right to him, and I think they do trust him. We saw them even have Drew Timmy operating on the high post and then throw the really nice cross-court pass to LeBron, who was able to hit a three. I thought they really did what they could. maybe it wasn't entirely intentional because it's Drew Timmy. He's, you know, on a two-way contract, but they put him in a group that I thought allowed him to maximize his strengths while minimizing his weaknesses. And that was impressive. And you, when you mentioned the playing hard piece, that's going to be important here for the Lakers. But Jovan, going back to your point though, too, it's also not ideal when you need certain guys on the team to be getting buckets in order for them to play hard.
Yeah, I really have been impressed by Timmy's last couple games. To your point, Trevor, I liked how JJ deployed him in the second game more so than the first game. Mm-hmm. But of course, the first game, no DA, no Jackson. So part of that was, you know, out of necessity. But he's an interesting player because offensively, I love him. I think that, you know, we've seen the post game. I mean, he was scoring on Klingon in the post in that Portland game. He can pump and drive. He can be a pick and pop big, even pick and roll and hit those little floaters and runners. He can also be like, I thought last night there was a lot of, you know, post ups with him spacing on the weak side and that drawing the Raptors defense over to him a little bit and making those stunts and rotations over a little bit trickier. I think the issue is if we're, and for me, I try to like look at this in like a contention lens or just sort of against the best teams, he is a defensive liability and he's not rebounded the ball. I mean, he played 30 minutes against Portland and I believe had three rebounds and last night had three. So like, I think he's limited athletically to a degree that you probably have to play him at the four. I don't think you could play him at the five against the serious team. Again, as we saw, like the performance versus Portland versus, compared to Toronto, I thought he looked much better at the four next to DA and LeBron and Vando. And it's like, okay, if you make him the, you know, second worst rebounder in a lineup and give him a certain amount of size and athleticism, he looks better, but you have to protect him defensively. So I think that's the one limitation there of even compare, like he's much better offensively than Maxi Kleba, but I trust Maxi Kleba a lot more defensively to be in certain positions to make certain reads and to actually be able to execute it. Like that's been the one thing Maxi's been able to do this season has been like the Lakers defense has been better with Maxi on the floor, despite the offense craters because there's some limitations there, but I like it. I think it's interesting. I just, again, overall, like this team talked about it at the top, ninth in offense, 26th in defense. I don't think Timmy is helping on the defensive end. So that's where ultimately I think they need to still add some defensive players into the rotation.
And I think it goes to when we've been talking about this quite a bit about the types of players the Lakers have been targeting. We look at the back end of their bench and where certain teams, especially the team the Lakers are going to see tomorrow, the Denver Nuggets, have found guys deeper in the rotation that have stepped up in big ways for guys who have been out, and specifically Nikola Jokic has been out, but they've dealt with a bunch of other injuries where the Lakers have struggled a little bit more to find NBA players near the end of their bench, guys who can step in and at least play at an NBA level. So in that sense, just finding a guy, if we'll see, it's two games, if Drew Timmy can be an NBA level player, even if his skill set doesn't fit exactly what the Lakers are looking for, then that would be a big win. You find, even if, look, we talk all about how they go after these small combo guards who don't defend particularly well or struggle in certain areas, right? You pick up Gabe Vincent and Kendrick Nunn and Lonnie Walker and all these guys over the years when maybe they needed to target more defense. And now you've got Nick Smith Jr. Now you've got Kobe Bufkin. Dalton Connect hasn't really worked out. You've got all these guys that you've been trying. If any of those guys can at least produce at an NBA level, they may not be the skill set fit that you need. Maybe you've got some concerns about the types of players that you're targeting. But right now, when these Lakers have been hit by injuries, they've had a lack of just NBA quality players. So just in that sense, well, you may not check the box.
They have a bunch of small scoring guards.
Exactly.
That's the entire back end of the roster.
That's the back end of the roster. And so that's where, even if Timmy isn't quite the fit that you ultimately need, if he's an NBA level player, that could actually be a big positive for the Lakers. Agreed. Let's go. So we've got a few super chats coming in. I know we are going to get into those in just a minute, but the weekend on the whole, 2-3, not bad. I do want to call attention to one thing. You know, Jovan, you're talking about the fast break points. They've been winning the fast break battle. What's interesting, and I know the big answer to this is Austin Reeves is out, but over the last eight games, They have also dropped to now 16th in the NBA in free throw attempts per game. That number is sliding very quickly. And we've talked about how they need to get to the line. The Raptors had a free throw edge for a while in last night's game. The Lakers ultimately won the free throw battle by 2 attempts. Jason, where are you at on the Lakers and their free throw shoot? Are you concerned at all about that slide, or is it, in terms of the way the game's being officiated, or is that just as simple as Austin Reeves is out?
I feel like Luka has been getting a worse whistle, but that it actually will kind of benefit him in the long run, in the sense that I thought he had a stretch there a couple weeks ago where he was almost exclusively grifting when he would be kind of working his way along the lane line. And I thought it kind of was a contributor to some of the turnover and shooting issues that he was having. That's not to say that you don't want Luka to focus on it at all, because I mean, as much as I don't find it aesthetically appealing when him or Shea do the junk that they do along the lane lines, it is a net additive to their offense in the form of points, you know, and then getting to slow the game down and get into their half court defense fully set up. But I do think that there's a lot of truth to the fact that those calls just get much harder to come by when you get to the postseason. And so if Luka makes an adjustment that gears his play style more towards, you know, the kinds of things that are reliable in the postseason, I think it could be beneficial. I think more than anything, Austin, without him, it's the lack of the drives. And the more drives and more dribble penetration you get, the more often you have the defense out of position. The more often you have the defense out of position, the more you're going to get to the foul line. And that will manifest in free throw attempts that are the kind that actually will be reliable in the postseason. Like, if you hit Jackson in the pocket or DA in the pocket and they just get hacked going down the lane, those are free throws that'll be there in the postseason. But in order to do that, you have to engage the rim protector. In order to engage the rim protector, you really got to get downhill with speed and pick and roll, which is something that Austin does. And so in general, I think Austin will help them boost their totals just with his own grifts and with his own dribble penetration. But like, I more or less am good with the around the league with fewer grifts being rewarded with free throws.
I actually thought, and I bring this up because last night's game, I thought this was a game where obviously you had to adjust a bit on the fly. If you compare the way the game was officiated the first quarter against the Blazers compared to the way last night's game was officiated, it's like they were using two different rule books. And that's the frustration from players, is the inconsistency night to night. But I thought last night was, I don't know if it's a turning of the page, but it was a rare game where the game got more physical and the Lakers were actually the aggressor. The Lakers took advantage. We saw the Raptors complaining a lot about calls being missed and things of that nature. The referees were letting them play, and it was the Lakers who took advantage of that situation. So, Jovan, I just wanted to highlight that. The free throw attempts have dropped. Perhaps the free throw calls around the NBA are shifting a bit. But we'll see what this means moving forward. But I thought the Lakers were the aggressor, and that was a rare thing for them because they were very reliant upon foul shooting up until this point.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. Like, again, kind of going back to them leveraging their size, I thought they did a great job of that and swarming Toronto. I think it helps. Like, I do think there's a bit of a correlation, in my opinion, in some of the Lakers' better defensive performances coming against teams that can't really shoot. And that has been a trend that I've noticed of, like, I mean, we know LA is not good at defending the 3-point line, both in terms of rotating out, closing out, running people off the 3-point line. Like, that has been an issue for them all season. So if you are having a poor shooting night, or you just can't really shoot based on your team's personnel, I think that allows LA to play the defensive style that they prefer to play, which is more that compact shell, you know, packing the paint and then leveraging some of that length and size that they have, because that is their superpower defensively, right? It's not the speed, it's not the athleticism. They don't have like great technical defenders up and down the roster. It's just a lot of, again, I think that 2-3 zone was like the embodiment of the best version of this team, because it also, I think, engages you in a way that the Lakers can go through the phases where they're sort of just going through the motions defensively, but with a zone, unless you, I mean, you can be checked out in a zone as well, and it looks really bad, but a zone does kind of give you a little bit more responsibility of you have to guard this area. You have to box out, because if you don't box out, you give up a bunch of offensive rebounds. You don't want to be back cut into the middle of the zone. So like it can almost force a team or individual players to be a little bit more engaged. And I think you saw that last night, but yeah, I thought they dictated the terms of engagement physically in a way that they tried to do in Portland, but it sort of backfired, and it was nice to see.
The Raptors shot 22% from three last night. Was that the Lakers defense, or was that just a bad shooting night from the Raptors?
I'm with Jovan. I think it's a combination of both. I generally think that shooting has so many different variables that you can control. Like, to your point, like if you're playing with more aggression and you're in general playing with more energy and verve, your guys are going to shoot more confidently compared to the way the other team is shooting. Like, I think teams tend to take on the personality of their stars in that way in a lot of ways. Not a foolproof concept, as the Lakers had some games this week where their stars played great, but guys couldn't hit shots. But you get the point. I think all those things are connected. I generally agree with Jovan, though. Like, teams that have two, three guys on the floor that are not lasers, those are the kinds of teams that JJ can kind of build a defensive game plan that will tilt things in those directions. And I do think that, like, when you, in the same way that the Lakers have had games where opponent defensive game plans have tilted shots toward Jared Vanderbilt, you know, it's like, I think that that's more or less the kind of result that you can expect. But obviously, like, I think there have also been games against good shooting teams where teams have just gone cold. Variance is a part of it, but I think I'm with Jovan. I think that the Lakers in general just match up really poorly with teams that can shoot the basketball well. Teams that can drive and kick to shooters are going to cause problems for them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's been an issue, and that's been for the last few seasons. We've seen the driving kicks, because they can't contain at the point of attack, collapses the defense, drive kick, open three. That's been a challenge for them, and that's something we'll have to keep an eye on for tomorrow night for sure. Before we get into the Grammy trip and all of that, Senpai had an interesting comment here. He said, in 18 games without Austin Reeves, and we appreciate the super chat, by the way, Senpai, said Luka and LeBron on, the Lakers are plus +5. LeBron on, Luka off, the Lakers are plus +8. Luka on and with LeBron off is a minus -8. Is that a Luka thing, or is that JJ needing to figure out the non-LeBron minutes? And I want to get your takes on this, because I felt like, especially in that second quarter, when LeBron was on the floor, he had the Banshees out there largely with him. He had guys that were really, he had Marcus Smart, he had Jared Vanderbilt flying around, he had Drew Timmy on the floor, and Drew Timmy was playing at a very high motor moment in that game. Luka came out and he had Rui and he had Gabe and he had these guys that were decisively lower energy compared to the guys LeBron was on the floor with. Is that, how much of it's Luka, how much of it is the rotation, and how do you solve this discrepancy?
I think the Lakers have figured something out here with these lineups in different units of LeBron plus the Banshees. Those groups have really worked. I think about like the Phoenix game going back. He was a big part of that 24-0 run that they had, you know, last month. But there's been several instances, you know, outside of that, including last night. I thought those groups played well. And you know, DA was in there, and you know, you had Marcus and Vando and Timmy. And then there's a couple variations. I thought Luka came in and also fit into the 2-3 zone well. But I think this speaks to, the Lakers are still figuring out the optimal way to deploy the big three, and it doesn't help that they've only had them for 8 games, right? Like, you ideally would like to see those guys together more and be able to, I believe it's been 8, maybe it's been 8 with the starters. I don't remember exactly how many games it's been with the big three, but I think one thing I'm starting to think about more is like, maybe it is LeBron sort of leading these Banshee groups and then Luka and Austin together. I just think Luka's better with another high level offensive threat out there, because when it's just Luka and guys who not even necessarily are the Banshees, but guys who can't necessarily create their own shot, if we're talking about like a Rui or a Gabe, they're not going to be breaking people down off the dribble consistently. Then it just becomes a lot of all the attention's on Luka. And it can sometimes, I think, goad him into taking some of those step back threes, or the ball is just in his hands a lot and the ball isn't moving and it's not necessarily on him. It's more so how the defense is guarding him, or just sort of the personnel that's out there with him. So I kind of like the idea of maybe stagger, like certainly need to stagger the big three to some degree. But I wonder if like Luka and Austin have crushed it together this year without LeBron, that they've been like, I think a 122 offensive rating. It's been awesome. So maybe some more Luka and Austin minutes together where you overwhelm offensively. And then you have the LeBron Banshee groups as the bench unit and see if that works. Cause I think those have been some of the better bench groups this season.
LeBron and the Banshees sounds like a 60s British invasion band or something like that, but I love it. It's interesting though, because going into the season, a lot of the conversation was Luka may have by himself minutes out there. Austin may, but LeBron would probably be LeBron and one of the other guys, especially when he was first getting back in. Now I agree that we may be shifting towards of the three, LeBron is the one who carries a unit by himself with the right players around him. Jason, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think that there's some proof of concept as to like how LeBron is succeeding in those units that I think is important to kind of focus in on, in the sense that the reason why, so let's just take like LeBron on, usually with Vando as an example of a player that struggles with Luka but succeeds with LeBron. LeBron and Vando with Luka and Austin off this year, they only have a 111 offensive rating, but they have a 103 defensive rating. And so that puts them at plus eight in 250 possessions. And I think one of the important kind of like details there is how often they get out in transition. So those groups perform extremely well off of turnovers. And so what ends up happening is LeBron is a force multiplier as a defense to transition weapon, because he's a very good rebounder and he's very good at throwing those kick ahead passes, running his lane, getting out in the open floor and making plays. And so they find this formula that works, which is put LeBron with these, we call them the Banshees, but just with the defensive minded role players. They get a bunch of stops, they get a bunch of rebounds, they run out in transition. That's where their success is. Whereas with, to your point, when you've got these defensive minded groups around Luka, it doesn't matter if they're not playing with a lot of energy and like up and down tempo to kind of accentuate the athleticism that they have around them. If they slow down in the half court and then Luka takes a bad three, and then they run down the other end for a transition bucket the other way, it's, you know, a huge negative swing. So I like the idea. We've seen a little bit of this with Rui already, but I like the idea of, in general, like, what is Luka going to be best at right now, leading a great offensive unit? Have those units just try to outscore everybody. That's where you should be playing, you know, Rui and Austin, you know, even Ayton, all of your best offensive players when LeBron's off the floor, and then lean into that like defense to transition element with LeBron. Essentially, like, you found your formula that works when LeBron's by himself. Find a formula that works with Luka. I think it would be more leaning towards offense.
Yeah, agreed. It makes sense. And that'll be really interesting to see. I believe Luka, Austin, and LeBron have only played like something like 290 possessions together on the floor.
And LeBron was a shell of himself at that
point. Yeah, and LeBron was not quite himself. So I'm really curious.
By the way, really quickly on that note, like, is there any greater evidence of just how far LeBron's come athletically than the fact that the last time he saw Scottie Barnes, he was completely overwhelmed by him, and then last night he was just doing whatever he wanted to him?
Oh, great point.
Great point.
Great point. Yeah.
That was the game he had the streak snapped.
Yep, exactly. Mm-hmm. But that's how far he's come in the last month, or however long it's been.
Speaking of streaks being snapped, first time in 21 years, LeBron's not been an all-star starter. Are you guys, is that the right call?
He missed too many games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He hasn't been a top five. Like if he wants to get in on, I think he's probably going to be an all-star, but I don't think he's been on the same level as those five guys. Yeah.
Well,
for what it's worth, I think Ant should have made it over Steph, but obviously, like, as a starter, both, like, I think those are the top six right now.
Yeah, we did that show, Jovan, you and I did last week on the all-star starters, who it should be, and LeBron barely squeaked on to the end of my list. He made it as an injury replacement on yours. I can't say, if LeBron was playing the way he's played over, I don't know, let's say the last 2-3 weeks for the end, didn't miss time, then he's in. He would have made it.
I have a theory that LeBron isn't going to miss another game this year unless he gets hurt.
Because of the 65 games?
Because he goes 5-7 over this last week. There was literally no reason for him to play in Portland. They had no ball handling and no bigs. But if he plays every game the rest of the season, he finishes with 65. So, like, from again, if he gets hurt, I think he'll sit. But if he's, like, sore slash tired, I think he's going to play the rest of the way.
Is that a good thing for the Lakers?
Probably not.
Yeah.
For the record, quickly on the topic of the big three, they have played. Okay, so it was 8 games together. They are 5-3. They played 140 minutes, and they have a minus 9.8 net rating together. So they got to figure that out.
Absolutely. They definitely do.
I think they're going to be better when Austin comes back, but we'll see.
Eric says, drop a like for the three basketeers, Athos, Porthos, and Aramis. Yeah, that's us right here. Make sure you guys hit that like button. Hit the subscribe as well. And don't forget to turn on those notifications. All right, let's get into the Grammy trip preview. This is, and we don't have to spend a ton of time on this, but it's a rough stretch. From here on out, from here until the All-Star break, the Lakers play every other day. So there's some consistency, I guess, with the exception of one back-to-back set that comes up mid-February, right before the All-Star break. But you
know who that back-to-back set is?
It's OKC and San Antonio.
OKC San Antonio.
Absolutely brutal. Absolutely brutal. That's the back-to-back set. But
both at home, yes. But yeah. That's
tough.
Two huge games.
Yeah, that's going to be rough. But 8 straight games now on the road. The Grammy road trip. Now, on the road, there is one of those games in LA because they're going to play the Clippers. But nonetheless, 8 straight games, not at Crypto.com Arena. What are you guys looking for here from this very long, prolonged absence from the Crypt?
There's some winnable games in here, too. Like, obviously, Denver's going to be without at least Jokic, presumably a couple other of their important players. They were resting Aaron Gordon yesterday against Charlotte, but I think he'll probably play tomorrow. The Clippers, I know Kawhi's got knee irritation, so I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't play on Thursday. Obviously, Dallas has no Anthony Davis, no Cooper Flagg, although they've been a little bit feisty as of late. Klay Thompson's hooping his you-know-what off. Like, he's a guy that, like, if he, by some miracle, got, like, bought out or something, I would pick him up just because this team can't shoot. There's some winnable games in there, but they're also all losable. So it's going to kind of fall into that similar, they're going to fall into that similar kind of trend that we were just talking about. Without Austin, this team is so dependent on whether or not guys are hitting shots and just all their guys are streaky and maybe yes, maybe no. And so I think, you know, I trust LeBron and Luka to kind of produce night in and night out over that span. I think they're going to ebb and flow based on how their role players play.
So let me just run down the list here. At Denver, and again, it's every other day. At Denver, the Clippers, Mavs, Bulls, Cavs, Wizards, Knicks, Nets. That's the stretch here, 8 games. Yovan, what does success look like during that 8-game stretch?
I think 5-3. Because I go back to this week, like when we were talking about this week, when we were previewing it, you know, a week or so ago, we were saying they should probably go 3-2 or 4-1, and they end up going 2-3. And yes, Sacramento and Charlotte have had some nice wins lately. Both those teams have been playing better, and they had incredible shooting performances against the Lakers. So some of that to a degree was like shot luck and whatnot working against the Lakers. But from a results perspective, I think this week was a disappointment. And I think, like, there have been certainly some silver linings here, right? Like the LeBron bench units, the LeBron-Luka two-man game, Luka's three is starting to fall. They've uncovered some stuff with Drew Timmy and Kobe Bufkin. There have been some nice things over this stretch recently, but they are 5-6 since Austin went out, and they only have one win against the team 500 or better over that stretch. So, like, I think at some point the results have to start mattering, right? And like they've been on this prolonged skid of 10-12 since December 1st. They need to get back on the other side of the ledger of 500 and start to have some stretches of winning more games than they are losing. So I look at this road trip as it's going to be tough. I think they've started, they have not been playing as well on the road lately. They had a great start on the road, and I think that started to progressively tail off a little bit. They've lost 3 straight road games. So I think for them, in my opinion, a win would be 5-3. I think that's going to be a tall task, but I look at, I would say like Cleveland and New York are totally justifiable losses. That those are two good teams that, especially with the way the Lakers have been playing recently and likely not having Austin or potentially getting Austin back, but he's still like a game or two back from a month long absence. Okay, those are understandable losses. Then I look at Denver and the Clippers as like, can you split those two games to start the trip? And like Denver's beaten some good teams without Jokic, even without Murray. The Clippers are obviously desperate right now. They are trying to make a run up the standings. So I think if you can split, go 1-1 to start the trip, beat Dallas, beat Chicago, lose Cleveland, beat Washington, lose New York, beat Brooklyn, you go 5-3. And anytime you go above 500 on a road trip, That is a win regardless of who you are. But especially with the caliber of opponent, there's some winnable, like Dallas, Chicago, Washington, and Brooklyn should be wins. Will they be wins? I don't know. The Lakers have also dropped some games to below 500 teams lately. Certainly, as Jason said, any game on this trip is losable. I would say Washington and Brooklyn, like they should be, like those should be wins. I think a loss to either one of those teams would be disastrous, but I think 5-3 should be the goal.
Have you heard anything about Austin, Jovan?
Not anything concrete, but it does. I mean, sounds like he could be back by the end of the month at some point on this trip, but not. I think that's more on the optimistic side.
Yeah, I think they're going to be very careful with the two, being a calf injury and the potential for that to become an Achilles thing and all that kind of stuff. So, and we also have to remember that.
And I wouldn't be surprised if he's on a minutes restriction. We've seen it now with Rui, where Rui's been on a minutes restriction all four games since returning from his calf injury, and it was not as serious as Austin's.
That begs an interesting question. When Austin returns, does he come off the bench? Because that's what they did with Rui here.
I doubt it. Not Austin.
Well, he did. Remember, he did come back off the bench in that Phoenix that's right, game. But that was a temporary thing. That immediately, I believe, the next game he started, because the next game was what it was the Houston game on Christmas, right?
So we heard it again.
I think I could see it being a temporary 1 or 2 game thing, but I don't think it's a permanent thing the way the Rui benching could potentially be permanent.
Yeah, agreed. Jason, 5-3.
I think that's I'm with Jovan. Anything over 500 on a trip like this would be a win, especially under the circumstances. Again, I think like I was talking about this with KOC on his show this morning, but like to me, like you know how alcohol is being consumed way less, and so Vegas is falling apart, but it's because alcohol is a part of every little thing in Vegas. That's the way I feel about Austin on the Lakers. Like he's just a part of like everything that they do.
Austin Reeves is alcohol.
Yeah, so like literally, like Austin is one of their best shooters. He's one of their best drivers. He's one of their best passers. He's unironically one of their best defenders in a way that's kind of depressing. So like he's also one of their best rebounding guards. Like he just so like I think without Austin, this is just an extremely mediocre team. So like them being
what Lakers specifically? What are we talking about?
Yeah,
I know this is what would be it'd have to be like Tito's, right? Something that goes in everything. But I mean the point is like in the same way that like as soon as people stopped drinking, Vegas fell apart. I feel like you took Austin off the Lakers and the Lakers fell apart. Like I think he's just too important to too many of their key areas. And so I like to me, it's literally just survival mode until he gets back.
Well, hopefully he's back sooner rather than later, but we'll see. I've been saying just to temper expectations, let's look to the All-Star break is right around when he would come back. If he's back anywhere near the end of the month, even if it's the first few days of February, I think that would be a real positive for the Lakers. I'm in agreement. 5-3 would be nice on this road trip. There's some tough games here. A lot of it, I think, is going to come down to can the team play with any kind of consistency from an energy standpoint. And I think there's going to be some off nights, but they're going to have to kind of grit their teeth and get through this portion of the schedule. This is a lot of games in a very, very busy month, and we're going to need to see these guys' energy ramped up on a night-in, night-out basis because you know you're going to get the best shot from a lot of these teams. All right, let's get into our Super Chat questions. We're going to get there in just a moment. First, a quick shout-out to our sponsor, and that is SeatGeek.
So my wife and I moved to Denver this summer, which means I'm finally back in an NBA city, and I can go to NBA games again. So obviously I want to see the Lakers before the end of the season, especially before LeBron retires. So I've been looking at Lakers Nuggets in March coming up to see if I can get some tickets. And this is why I want to give the sponsor of today's video, SeatGeek, a huge shout out. With over 35 million downloads, SeatGeek is the number one rated ticketing app. They have over 70,000 events listed on the app, obviously concerts and festivals, but sports as well, the NBA, the NFL. They even have World Cup tickets on sale right now. And my favorite thing about the app is just how easy it is to find the best deal because of their deal score. So like, these are the tickets to Lakers Nuggets in March. I can sort by deal, so I'm just looking at 10s on their deal score. These are all the best available deals in their respective sections, and look at how many options they have. So I can just pick the section in the arena I want to stay in or sit in, and I can find the best ticket in that section pretty easily. It makes that process so much easier. And they have your back. Every ticket is backed by their buyer guarantee. And of course, I have a code for you guys. You can use code LakersCollective10 for 10% off your next set of tickets at SeatGeek. That's 10% off any tickets with promo code LakersCollective10. Make sure you click on the link in the description to download the app. They have the code automatically added to your account so you can use it later. Thank you to SeatGeek.
All right. And again, a big thank you to SeatGeek. We appreciate them for sponsoring the show. Let's go here. Right off the bat, fake trade territory. Love the show. Pat Williams. And the Bulls first for Rui. I don't think the Bulls are kicking in a first to clear. They'd be clearing a lot of future salary in Pat Williams, but I don't think the Bulls are in a position to give up a future first. Take the first for Pat Williams' contract. LA now has two firsts and a second plus expirings to land Trey Murphy from the Pelicans. Again, I can't see the Bulls doing this. If you're the Lakers, I mean, you can certainly make the argument for it to pick up another first-round pick, reset the Stepien rule, especially if we're talking about a 2026 first. That could change a lot for them. But, guys, I can't imagine a scenario where the Bulls would think trading a first-round pick is a smart idea.
No. The one thing I will say is I have been more amenable to targeting more offensive-oriented shooting-type wings rather than just guys that can guard, just simply because this team is so bad at shooting the ball. Not that I think Trey Murphy's a pipe dream, but the point is I'm more like that's what kind of has had me geared more towards oh, what if you can poach Cam Johnson from the Nuggets this summer, like that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think that package lands you Trey Murphy. I don't think it gets you close to landing Trey Murphy. Like, I think the Lakers could offer the mother load of, let's just say they do this trade, they get the first, you offer the two firsts, you offer Rui. Well, I guess Rui's gone. So, you offer whatever the expirings, then you offer Dalton, you offer a do, you throw in like every little asset that you have. I don't think New Orleans does that. And I agree. I don't think Bulls give up a first to get off the Pat Williams contract. But even through that lens, it's like, I don't think the Pat Williams contract is good. I actually think it's kind of a bad contract sneakily. He's got three more years left at $18 million a year. That's a lot to pay for a guy who he has been.
Is it just me where Jovan's frozen?
I would say pretty stable the last few years. Like last year, he had a little bit of a down year, but I don't think I always view it from the lens of like, if this guy was on the open market, how much would they command? I don't even think he's getting the full non-taxpayer MLE if he's out there. So at $18 million, that becomes a bit of an anchor on your cap sheet. And I think you could argue a first is worth taking that on if you're the Lakers, but I don't think the Lakers would willingly be like, we want to attach ourselves to this guy making $18 million the next 3 years.
Agreed. Yeah, and the Bulls have Vooch, Collins, Herter, Kobe White, all these guys. You know, depending on what happens with Kobe White, I would assume move, but they've got a bunch of players coming off the books this summer. They're not in a position where they have to make that kind of a move. All right, let's go here. Can y'all rank the basketball IQ of the players on the roster? Include Timmy. That's what JJ's rotation will be. If you ain't 9 through 10, you ain't playing. Okay, I guess to spin it more positively, who are the highest?
You guys don't want me to do this.
Well, you're going to put the stars.
And I'm not going to do this.
Low IQ guys.
You're going to go Luka, LeBron, Austin off the top.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
I think Marcus is a high IQ player. I think he has bad impulse control. I don't know where you put that in the IQ rank.
Were you trying to log to LeBron last night? I was like, dude. Did you ever see the kids when you would go to the gym and they'd be like, here, I'm going to try to dunk. And they would like kind of go up and they would just let go of the ball and then grab the rim. Like yeah. That was literally what Marcus Smart did on his little baseline drive. I was like, dude, I don't think you were even remotely high enough to be thinking about doing that. But to your point, impulse control.
Yeah. Who else belongs on that list?
I think Jake's got a pretty high IQ. I think Gabe has a high defensive IQ, but that he similarly struggles with impulse control.
Yeah.
Offensively.
I don't know. There's a lot of names.
Yeah. I think it tails off after that.
That's fair. Drop off. All right. Grant said, I crammed it all together. Said, you guys often say Lakers need to mimic Mavs 23-24 finals team, build around Luka. Hypothetically, would you all trade the three unprotected first? So that's this summer. We're talking about three first for PJ Washington, who would be trade eligible this summer. Not right now. He is not. Najee, Daniel Gafford, and Lively for Rui. So you're getting everything from the Mavs, basically all their role players, for three firsts.
I would not give up three firsts for that package.
Yeah. Me neither. Also, guys, that team got their butts kicked in the finals. They were kind of a second tier contender that snuck through the West because Denver got upset by a really bad matchup in Minnesota. That's not to say that team wasn't good, but I mean, like, that team's not competing with the teams at the top of the league right now. Like, you need. What you need is a better version of the 2023-2024 Mavs, mm-hmm. like specifically better shooting. Like, I thought the Derrick Jones, PJ Washington inability to hit above the break threes really hurt them in the finals.
I don't think the goal should be to literally recreate that Mavs team player for player, but instead to add pieces that can fill some similar roles with, as Jason said, better shooting. All right, let's go here. Patrick said, Luka is the best player on the team. I'm not saying he's not, but the offense looks better when LeBron is in control. Seems more fluid. What are y'all's thoughts? And then he also throws in who y'all got on the Super Bowl. So we'll save the Super Bowl thing for just a moment. The offense looking better with LeBron, I think some of that is a symptom of when we're looking at LeBron's ability to get downhill and get down the floor into semi-transition, which is at a very different level than Luka's ability to do that. Although some of that is also probably tied to Luka's struggles shooting the three. He has gotten better the last few games, but there are a lot of complaints about, does Luka move the ball enough? Does the ball need to move more freely? Whereas LeBron, you see him a lot in the high post, surveying the floor, whipping the ball across the court, and guys are getting open looks out of that. Where are you at in terms of running the offense? Would you rather see Luka doing it or LeBron doing it? With obvious, the low-hanging fruit is that obviously both of them are going to need to, but who do you like running the offense more?
Well, I mean, I don't know that LeBron, like, we kind of saw LeBron run the offense in Portland. This would be my counterpoint, and it did not go great. I think LeBron can run the offense in doses and in shifts, right? And especially some of those banshee groups. But I think at this point, LeBron is probably better overall as a number two option in a high level offense, who can scale up to be the number one. And sometimes it's more of a 1A, 1B, and I think that's totally fine. But I think Luka does have an ability to assume a certain amount of usage that I know people get on him about that, and I understand it to a degree, but I think there's sometimes a notion that like everyone could just scale up their usage and put up similar numbers. I think most NBA players pretty much, I mean, there's very few players who could do it to the level that Luka does it in terms of having the type of usage that he has and the workload he has offensively and putting up comparable numbers. I don't think you just pick bench scorer X and say, hey, here's the ball, and they're going to be as impactful and effective as Luka. I disagree with that premise. So I think there is an element of, like, I think Luka still is the heartbeat of the offense, and this all works to some degree because of the attention that he draws from defenses. And again, when we think about like some of the best stretches of LA's offense this season, it has been teams completely selling out against Luka and triggering those 4-on-3, 3-on-2 situations. That said, aesthetically, I think it is fair to argue that when LeBron is getting downhill or LeBron is playing out of the post and you have those little flashes to the middle from DA or a kick out pass to the wing, that is maybe more aesthetically pleasing than some of when Luka's running the offense and he's taking a step back three that misses, or maybe he's trying to draw a foul and he doesn't get the call, and then he gets into it with the ref. And like, I can understand why people don't like watching that sometimes. So I think aesthetically you could argue LeBron, sometimes it looks a bit better, but I still think like we've seen each of the big three kind of run the show for stretches. And I would argue I still have liked the offense more with Luka and Austin at the helm than LeBron as like the primary driver.
I think it's 100% an aesthetic conversation, mm-hmm. because I agree with you, Jovan, like Luka is the best offensive player on the team by a mile. I don't think it's particularly close. I think the problem with what's happened with Luka's just had a lot of bad games this year. Like Luka's had 15 games this year with 5+ turnovers and a bunch of games where he can't make shots. And so like when you're watching Luka on the nights where he's missing and turning the ball over, it can be a real eyesore. But like what's happening in terms of the aesthetics is exactly what happened when Luka was playing with Kyrie Irving, which is like, every time Luka steps off the floor and Kyrie takes over the offense or LeBron takes over the offense, they play so much faster with so much like pace. And like, there's so much more of like a traditional look to the way that they target defenses that it like immediately almost feels like a breath of fresh air as a viewer, because you're like, okay, we've gone from him dribbling the air out of the basketball 35 feet from the rim into some sort of tough contested, you know, shot to we're playing real offense, you know, like, one of the things that's really stood out to me is the Lakers run a lot more sets when LeBron is on the floor by himself without Luka. So like a lot of horns, a lot of like, even if we're going to a LeBron post up, it's going to be out of some kind of action. They're going to run different, like LeBron will function a lot as a screener when he's on the floor with those guys to get the switches that he wants to work out of the post or to get into some sort of advantage situation. So there's just like more of a natural basketball flow in those units, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, again, that he's a better offensive player. Like we've talked about it. We went over the numbers earlier, those LeBron Vando groups, they're winning their shifts and they're helping the Lakers win games, but they're not doing it by scoring. They're doing it by defending. Like their offense has been pretty mediocre in those groups, but I think it's just a testament to the fact that LeBron is still finding a way to lead units in his own way. But yeah, like if the game is like, we need someone to run spread pick and roll for the next 5 minutes, you're going to Luka every single time.
When it comes to engagement of everybody else on the team, I don't think there's any question that the LeBron aesthetics are something that's going to foster more engagement from the other players on the team. With you're running more sets, you're getting more guys involved than Luka with the ball at the top, step back three in situations where he feels like he's got to be the entire offense. So beyond just the aesthetics of it, is there enough of a benefit, despite Luka being the best offensive player on the team, is there enough of a benefit from getting everyone else involved the way that LeBron can versus perhaps the way Luka does, which Luka does pass the ball still. He gets a high number of assists, but the way LeBron engages the rest of the team, is there a benefit to that that may even the playing field a little bit, even if Luka is a better offensive player than LeBron?
There can be. Right. I think like to get to the heart of the question, I think, again, to reiterate what I said, like, I think you could argue that there's an aesthetic element to LeBron being at the helm of Jason hit on it. I think they are more organized offensively. There is more variety to the offense. So you will see the horns and elbow actions, the post-ups, but there'll also be some pick and roll mixed in there. Whereas with Luka, it is primarily going to be one of two things. It's going to be either high pick and roll or some variation of like a double drag or stack action, or it's going to be him coming off the weak side off of a wide pin down, going into probably a two-man action with one of the bigs. So I think there's like a little bit, but like the thing is with Luka that I think is so, I think adds an aesthetic element to it as well, is like Luka can have these stretches where he's just hitting ridiculous shots that very few players in the league can hit, but also like, you know what's coming and you still can't stop it a lot of the time with Luka, right? So I don't know if we're talking like aesthetics or like actual results, those are two different things here. I totally understand people who prefer the LeBron style more than the Luka style, if that is like how you prefer offense. Looking at it here quickly, this stretch of 11 games without Austin, with Luka on the floor, the Lakers have a 117.4 offensive rating, which leads the team. With LeBron on the floor, they have a 114.8 offensive rating, which obviously about 2.6 points per 100 possessions worse. So from a results perspective, as Jason said, Luka's clearly the best offensive player on the team. The offense is still at its best with Luka on the floor. But I do think there could be something to the ball probably moves a little bit more. It's more guys are involved when LeBron is at the helm.
I think Luka plays just in general a super unorthodox style of basketball that is difficult for a lot of people to kind of process. That's kind of the weird thing when you get to the top of the league. Like, I find both Shea and Luka to play a pretty tough to watch brand of basketball. Like, I was watching Shea in the Heat game, like on three straight possessions in the late third quarter, like just throw his body into somebody and throw something up, you know? And it's like, it's hard to watch. It's brutal to watch. And like, when, you know, when for years and years we watched players go to the post and, you know, shoot hook shots or turnarounds, and Luka's like doing that weird, like just step right into the guy, low gather, you know, shot that's just like a garbage fake basketball shot, but he's doing it on every post up. Like, that's, it's hard to watch. Like, it is what it is. Like, this is our lot in life if we're covering the Lakers over the next 5 years. Like, it's, we're gonna have one of the very best players in the world who plays a difficult brand of basketball to watch. It's just the nature of the partnership there. But I think one of the things with Luka is I do think that there are stretches where he does get into these shot making runs and he starts making these unbelievable passes, and he can be very fun to watch in those stretches. It's just kind of the in between, you know, when he's not necessarily hitting at that rate, that can get tough to watch.
And I think you touched upon something in that it's different than what we've come to expect from what good offensive basketball tends to look like. And that, just inherently human nature, is that we see something that's different than what we're expecting to see. And there can be a revulsion, might be too far, but there's an immediate response that, well, that's not what I was expecting to see. So that must not be a good thing. Now, you're right. There are moments where it can be difficult to watch. There's moments where he's absolutely brilliant as well. Mm-hmm. But it being so much different than I think what people have become accustomed to for years in the NBA in terms of how Luka plays offensive basketball, and that's going to create a bit more disdain for what he does as well.
And one thing I just want to be clear on here, because I saw some of the dialogue in the chat. Uh-huh. We're talking about the current version of LeBron. We're not doing a retroactive on LeBron's entire career. Yeah. And who, like, we're talking about right now.
Yeah. And nor are we even really, like, it's LeBron and Luka are Lakers.
This is all awesome. Just like a hypothetical, like just you know, theoretical discussion here. This isn't, I don't think this discussion is going to have any like change on how the Lakers run their offense. It's just more so what we think.
All right, let's, we'll finish off with a couple of quick ones here. all right, I've got one I'll get to. Are the Lakers waiting for Giannis? I don't think they're specifically waiting for Giannis. I know there's some teams that are. I don't think the Lakers are specifically waiting for Giannis. I think if they don't find the right move right now at the trade deadline, and they happen to have three picks to use this summer, and Giannis happens to hit the market at that point, I would imagine they probably make a call or two. But I don't think they're specifically waiting in the hopes that they can go land Giannis.
I don't think they're outright waiting for Giannis in the sense of like not doing a move because of a potential Giannis trade. But I do think their bar for trading a first round pick being so high is in part because of what could potentially happen this summer, be it Giannis or another star or high level starter. So I think they want to go big game hunting to a degree. Doesn't, again, have to necessarily be another superstar, but like, you know, if I mean, Jaren Jackson Jr., not for Austin Reeves, but like, does he potentially become available? Could you have two or three picks to try to go get him or someone like another, or maybe now you have a couple picks, you can go get Herb Jones if you so choose, if you think that's an appropriate price for him. So having the 2 to 3 picks, again, depending on when they make a trade, because they lose the third. Like one thing I continue to hammer is they have 3 picks on draft day. Then they will make that 2026 pick unless they trade it. And then all of a sudden they have 2 picks. So they have like 3 picks for like 24 hours, basically, or less than 24 hours to make some sort of move. And then they will have to draft that 2026, whoever is their first round pick. And then they have the 2031 and 33 to trade, in addition to, I guess, technically a rookie if someone wants that player. But I would say that they're not like waiting for him, but I also don't think they are being as proactive to potentially have a big domino fall in their lap this summer.
Exactly. They don't want to miss out on something this summer because they make a move now, unless it's for sure the right thing to do right now. All right, let's go. I'll finish with this. I'm assuming the answer is no. Jovan or Trevor, did you see Trevor's dinosaur lesson? Jovan and Jason.
No, but I'm into it. I'm a big dinosaur guy.
No.
Also, love
is this all the sexy or the Tyrannosaurus?
Yes. The LeBronosaurus. Yeah, that was... I've been doing this thing when the Lakers win. I threw in a history analogy at one point a few weeks ago. I used to be a history teacher. And so when the Lakers win, I've been throwing in a little fun but true history lesson at the end. I happened to come across last night that funny cartoon of a Tyrannosaurus Rex with LeBron's features on it and wearing a crown and all of that. And so I built a minor dinosaur lesson of just animals that were alive today, or that are alive today, that were also around when the dinosaurs were around because they were playing the Raptors, and we did this whole thing based off of that. And of course the punchline was getting to that that LeBron was actually alive when the dinosaurs were around, and he was the LeBronosaurus as the oldest player in the NBA and all of that. So that was what it all ultimately led up to last night, the little mini lesson at the end of the show. It was a good time. It maybe also it's a little bit of mid-season madness kicking in as well. All right, everybody, we'll wrap things up there.
Two big games note. Before our next show.
Two very big games.
Yeah, if you win and both of those, you win. If you win tomorrow, you're only a game back at Denver in the loss column.
That's right.
And Denver currently has the 4th best record in the league.
Oh, we never addressed the Super Bowl question, and I wanted to ask you, Jay, you're in Denver. What's the mood?
Denver fans are pretty bummed,
yeah,
for obvious reasons right now. A lot of Jared Stidham optimism, though. People are saying this quality backup quarterback play.
He hasn't taken a snap since, is it 2023? Is that right?
Something crazy like that. Yeah. I will say that that defense should give them a chance against anybody. But it's I think that was a kill shot. I thought Bo played incredible.
He did
on Sunday.
He did.
Or Saturday, I should say.
I'm going to go Rams over Patriots in the Super Bowl. I mean, LA guys, so I'm a little biased there. I got to pick the Rams. One quick note that it just to add to the Luka conversation here, he finished, so he was first in fan voting. He was 6th in player voting, which is interesting. Was not a starter by the players, but was tied with Jokic for 2nd in media voting. So it was Shea first, Jokic and Luka tied 2nd.
Who was ahead of Luka in the player voting?
Ahead of Luka, so player voting, it went Jokic 1, Steph 2, Shea 3, Ant 4, KD 5, Luka 6.
Ooh, KD over Luka. I wonder, because it would have been around that time that the players were voting, if his little run-in with Dennis Schroeder had anything to do with that. And that making its way around the player circles and around the NBA. Mm-hmm. All right, everybody. Appreciate all of you for joining. Please make sure you hit that subscribe button if you haven't done so yet. We're back on Friday. Is that right, guys?
Friday.
Yes, sir. I'll be in a new spot.
Let's go, dude. Good luck with the move.
New background.
Yeah, heck yeah.
That's right. Enjoy moving time.
Thanks good luck again, with whatever giant crisis pops up, because you know how that goes, man.
We already had one, so I'm hoping there's not a second one.
Thank you, everybody. See ya and stay safe.